We're celebrating Independence Day here on Texas Scorecard Radio. Our top news, something else to celebrate, a big setback for the political prosecutors who've been going after Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Also, we've got some good news out of North Texas, a legislative success story there. For our interview, we talked to Elizabeth Graham of Texas Right to Life about the dismal state of Texas patient rights laws. And Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan will close us out with this week's commentary. Coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas, this is Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald. You can find us on the web, www.texasscorecard.com. Let's get started real quick with this week's top story. I've got Carrie Cheshire, Vice President for Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. A big setback for the crooked prosecutors on the Paxton case. Good news.
That's right, Tony. The witch hunt might finally be coming to an end.
Yep. You know, this is a story we could spend an entire show, I think, chronicling the saga of it. But basically, you have a political prosecution called that by, I think, the Wall Street Journal, national publications, a political prosecution against Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. It's been stalled for years. Just in the last couple of weeks, the Court of Criminal Appeals now ruling that the pay deal, where these private criminal defense attorneys who were appointed by Paxton opponents to go after him, being thrown out. They can't be paid the massive sums of money that they wanted to be paid to be special prosecutors. And we're even seeing one of the lawyers, one of the third prosecutor on the case, drop out of the case or trying to drop out of the case.
That's right, Tony. Just earlier this week, Nicole DeBord announced that she would be withdrawing from the case. Of course, this has continued, kind of legal quagmire for them as the court is saying you can't be paid the astronomical sum of money you thought you were going to be paid. Also, a lot of the charges you were bringing were bupkis.
They haven't ruled on, there's not a way to get a ruling on the substance of it. There was a federal court case that said there's no merit to this case, but this criminal thing's still there. But now basically these guys have to make a choice. Do you want to do the case, this political case, for free, essentially, or very little money? Or was it really just all about getting paid?
Yeah, and I think we'll find out. You know, they said all the time that this was about, the public service to the state of Texas, but then they got that backroom deal where they were making $300 an hour. So without the $300 an hour, let's see if they're just as committed to what they said was public service at the forefront of all of this.
Yeah, it's a good news for the taxpayers, particularly taxpayers of Collin County who were on the hook. And we'll have to keep an eye on where this goes. Do these guys show their true colors and drop the case, or do they try and stick on with this case that shouldn't, and really needs to be dropped? But we'll have to see what happens. The special prosecutors there, big setback, good news for taxpayers, good news for Attorney General Paxton, something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, absolutely right, Tony. And it's hopeful for taxpayers that this ongoing legal saga might finally come to an end.
Next, let's turn and go to North Texas and talk with Aaron Anderson with the Metroplex Bureau. Success story up there. Tell us about it.
Well, that's right, Tony. A part of the new property tax reform bill, Senate Bill 2 that passed this session, included a new conflict of interest measure that prevents what was a pretty glaring conflict where elected officials who set tax rates were also serving on appraisal district boards who value the properties that are taxed. And we had written a while back about a particular instance up here in the Metroplex in Denton County. Denton County's chief appraiser, Rudy Durham, was also the mayor of Lewisville, one of the biggest taxing entities.
Yeah, so this was, I think we'd covered this a while back, a conflict of interest where he's the one doing the appraisals, but he's also one of the governing officials who's setting the tax rates and, pulling in taxes.
Right, and then the ones spending that money raised. So that seemed like a pretty big conflict, and we wrote about it, and in fact, we talked with Senator Paul Bettencourt, who's a property tax guru at the time, and he said, well, yeah, this is absolutely a glaring conflict of interest. It shouldn't be happening. And he said he would file legislation in the next session to address this problem and eliminate it. And in fact, that's exactly what happened this session.
Yeah, so Senator Betancourt filed a bill in the Senate. Also, I think Pat Fallon, senator from Denton County, also filed legislation there. And then some in the House moved through the process. Tell us a little bit about how that actually finally passed.
Right. So Senator Betancourt's bill was the one that got picked up and moved through the Senate. It made it over to the House, but like a lot of bills, got hung up in calendars and didn't progress. So when the larger property tax reform, Senate Bill 2, came over to the House for negotiations, State Representative Matt Krause actually added an amendment to SB 2 to address the same issue. And in fact, went a little farther than Betancourt's original bill. The amendment says, which is now in the bill, in the law, is that individuals can't be employed by the appraisal district if they're an officer or employee of a taxing unit that's in that district.
Yeah, so not just the chief appraiser, but anybody
right.
there. So it's a real success exactly. story. So this guy in Denton, he's now resigning. He's no longer on the city council, right?
Well, he hasn't resigned yet, but he says he will. He's been on Louisville City Council for a couple of decades. He's been the mayor since 2015 of Louisville, a very big city there. He's been in the appraisal district for 25 years and chief appraiser since 2012. He says he's keeping his day job, the paying job, obviously, which pays about $184,000
a year. Wow.
And going to step down at the end of the year, he says, from his position, his elected position as mayor of Louisville, and then the city will hold a special election next year to replace him.
It's great. Well, that's a success story if I've ever heard one.
Well, I agree. You know, promise made, promise kept, and an end of a conflict of interest.
Thanks for your reporting on it, Aaron.
Thanks, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
For this week's interview, I reached all the way back into the Texas Scorecard Radio archives, all the way back to episode 7, to an interview I had with Elizabeth Graham of Texas Right to Life about the dismal state of patients' rights protections in Texas law. Unfortunately, these things haven't really changed over the last couple of years, and so the interview is just as informative today as it was when we first ran it. I hope you find it informative. Well, it's a pleasure to have our friend Elizabeth Graham with Texas Right to Life on the line with us here with Texas Scorecard Radio. Elizabeth, how are you?
I'm well, Tony. Thanks for having me. And I'm honored that Empower Texans would include me.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you on the show. You know, first of all, get started. Let's get the website out there so people know your organization, and then we can talk a little bit about the work y'all do.
TexasRightToLife.com, and Twitter is at TXRightToLife, all spelled out.
Well, you know, thanks for coming on the show. We wanted to talk a little bit about the issue of end of life. I know as a, you know, I'm a pro-life Texan conservative. I know a lot of other conservatives. And I think whenever we think of the pro-life issue, it's mostly defined as anti-abortion. And I think that's actually relatively easy for folks to understand. But your organization is involved in end of life as well. And we wanted to talk a little bit about kind of what is going on with Texas on the end of life issue, and what a pro-life Texan who knows that they're anti-abortion ought to know about the end of life issue here in the Lone Star State as well. So can you tell us a little bit about the work that your organization does on end of life? And let's talk a little bit about where Texas is on this issue of end of life.
Well, I would ask for a clarification, because not everyone who is victimized by the Texas law is at the end of their life. So we prefer to call these patients' rights issues or medical ethics issues, only because Texas has the worst law in the nation regarding patients' rights and advance directives. It's basically euthanasia with a 10-day notice. The Texas Advanced Directive Law in our health and safety code allows doctors and hospitals to override your wishes if you're asking for medical treatment. And so if the doctors or hospitals think that your quality of life or you're too sick to merit further treatment, or if they just don't want to care for you anymore, they can hold a meeting. And at the meeting, they talk about you. And after the meeting, they will give your family a notice of their decision. And generally, the decision is that within 10 days, they are going to withdraw treatment. And that usually does speed or cause the death of the patient. Many of these patients are actually not at the end of their lives, Tony. So that's why we prefer to call this medical ethics or advanced directive issues.
Yeah. Okay. So are the parent, the family, even in the room when these decisions are made? Is this something that's just being made for patients?
Well, excellent question. Families are invited or encouraged to attend, but regardless of the family participation, or it's actually not participation, regardless of the family's presence at the meeting goes ahead. The statutory process is as follows. If a doctor or hospital wants to make the move to withdraw treatment, they have to give the family notice of a 48 hours notice of this meeting. And when the 48 hours notice of the meeting is given, there is paperwork that accompanies the notice saying that we're going to have this meeting. Here's a copy of the statute that allows us to have this meeting. We're having this meeting because you've requested treatment. We think the patient's futile. You're encouraged or invited to attend the meeting. And here's a list of organizations that will help you figure out what we're talking about.
So,
and Texas Right to Life is on that registry that's given to families. And so sometimes families call us for help before the meeting, after the meeting. Sometimes they want us to go to the meeting with them. So that's the 48-hour notice provision.
So to make this clear, so these are hospital panels that are making decisions.
Yes.
Against the will of the family. The family's wanting one outcome and the hospital's making a different decision.
Or even the patient. We have helped patients who are conscious and who have said, I want continued medical treatment. So these are even patients who can speak for themselves. So we're not looking at a person who is in a quiescent state or a semi-conscious or minimally conscious state. That some of those patients are, yes, but this has even happened to patients who are fully conscious. And when the patient himself or the surrogate or the authorized family member is asking for treatment and the doctor and the hospital have decided they don't want to continue treatment, then they start this ethics committee process. And at the meeting, the facility or the ethics committee, or it's been called a death panel, now we hear it's called a critical and palliative care service team, which is kind of frightening.
That's very Orwellian, kind of complicated.
Yes, they come in a number of names. Memorial Hermann in Houston uses this critical, it's either critical and palliative care, critical and palliative services team or something like that. Nevertheless, the ethics committees come in all different names, and they have the meeting with or without the family. And at the end of the meeting, they give the family or the patient the written decision of what the committee deliberated about and what they decided on. And usually that means within 10 days, the hospital is going to withdraw treatment, and that leads to the death of the patient.
Wow. So are there some real-world examples that you could give to listeners of situations that have gone on, that, you know, particularly that Right to Life has been involved in, where this has, you know, been a moral outrage?
Well, we've actually helped in the range of over 300 patients since 2003. The law passed in 1999, and in 2003, the law was updated to include this registry that is given to patients and families when the statutory process is started. And so since 2003, we've taken about two to four calls a month of families who are calling for help. And Tony, what's frightening is we wonder how many people haven't called us for help because they just are not clear on what the process is. But yes, I can tell you a number. There was a 16-year-old girl, Sabrina, who went into the hospital with a staph infection that had traveled to her brain. So she had part of her skull temporarily removed to address the brain swelling. And this is a 16-year-old all-star athlete, gem of a girl, straight-A student, in light of her parents' eyes. And she, after brain surgery, you know, of course her head was dressed, but she had an open skull. She was put on a floor that was unmonitored by a nurse. And the person who was in charge hadn't passed the board exams in 3 years. So here's this 16-year-old girl who goes into a hospital with a staph infection, had this horrible surgery, which is clearly a case of medical malpractice, and the hospital made a move to start the 10 days to cover up their mistakes.
Oh my God.
Because this poor child ended up permanently disabled. And physically disabled, confined to a wheelchair, had to eat through a feeding tube, was never able to go back to school. And we've seen other situations where the 10 days has been started to cover medical malpractice mistakes. But one of our earliest cases I remember was a former veteran and a fellow who was a bus driver in Dallas, a school bus driver. And his wife called and said, "We have this letter, what do we do?" And an attorney in Dallas volunteered to help them. They didn't want to sue. They just wanted to understand the process. And so the attorney in Dallas talked to the hospital. It was Baylor in Dallas, and said, "What's going on? This guy is not dying. Yes, he's very sick. He knows he's sick. In fact, he drove himself to the emergency room because he's had heart problems all his life. And he didn't feel well, so he wanted to get to the hospital because he was afraid he had pneumonia." Well, they ignored his pneumonia, and they just wrote him off as having heart problems. So his pneumonia got worse, and the hospital made the move to withdraw treatment. And they made the ethics committee, they gave the 10-day letter, and then the attorney called the hospital and said, "You know, he's not dying, he's going to recover. Could you just revoke the 10 days? We're trying to transfer him." Well, we transferred, it was a nasty battle, but the hospital rescinded the 10-day letter. We helped move the patient to a rehab facility where he recovered, and he lived 4 more months. And on the day he was dying, he turned to his wife and he said, "Thank you for fighting for me. I'm feeling sick. I think it's my time to go."
Wow.
And she stood up, held his wife's hand while he was dying. And she stood up and said, "Sweet, sweet woman," said, no, "let me go get the nurse." And he said, "No, baby, this is the way I wanted to die. Thanks for fighting for me. I think it's my time."
And this is 4 months. 4 months after they've placed this DNR?
Oh. Well, this we don't know. The DNR is separate than the 10-day law. And I'm actually glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I think there's some. I may have some confusion about that. You can clarify that for me.
Up until a month ago, Texas law was silent on do not resuscitate orders and how they're executed and what patients' rights are. And so many times what we heard is that the patients who are subjected to this ethics committee process and then the 10-day law, we've heard that the doctors have written DNR orders, do not resuscitate orders, for these patients, in addition to making the move to withdraw treatment. And so whenever Texas Right to Life has been involved, we always ask the families, or in some cases the hospitals, is there a do not resuscitate order for the patient? And whenever the answer is yes, we ask the family, did you authorize that? Did you know about this? Do you want a do not resuscitate order? And most of the time the answer is no. And so we found out that the doctors will write a DNR order without even telling the patient or the family. So we've had those DNR orders revoked. And that's kind of lumped into the Texas Advanced Directive Law, because doctors will write DNR orders in the process of the ethics committee just so they, you know, can make sure that the person isn't given treatment. But separated now, the do not resuscitate order was addressed in the special session of the legislature, and hospitalized patients now are protected from unwanted DNR orders. And so a doctor has to seek consent from the patient or the patient's authorized surrogate or family member before writing a do not resuscitate order on the patient.
Well, that seems like a no-brainer, but it was a big victory for Right to Life to kind of get that placed in the law.
Whole law needs to be overhauled, but there have been some incremental steps in the last couple of sessions that are very helpful and that put us on the path to full reform. So the do not resuscitate order bill was one of those steps, and that was a very significant win.
on DNR, and this is something I wasn't familiar with until I got, you know, to know you all with Right to Life. This isn't just, you know, extraordinary measures to revive a patient. It can be basic things like CPR, you know, that kind of thing, right?
Exactly. So there's a number of procedures, shall we say, on a do not resuscitate order. And so one of them can be cracked ribs, you know, chest compressions that can crack the ribs. One of them can be an injection that restarts your heart. I'm not going to get the name right, so I won't even try to explain that. But another one is helping the person restart breathing. And I'm not getting all of the technical medical terms correct. So you can do a DNR, a modified DNR, or you can have no DNR, but that should be your choice as a patient. You know, you don't want to take a fragile old woman into the hospital and say, do chest compressions because you could crack a rib.
Right, right.
So if she's in the process of a dying and her lungs are not processing or exchanging oxygen for carbon dioxide and her lungs are full of fluid, you know, she's probably going to have trouble breathing, but you don't necessarily want to go the full way to start her compressions and get her breathing. I'm sorry, you don't want to go the full DNR because you could crack her ribs and cause further harm to her. But there are other ways to resuscitate that type of patient if she has cardiac arrest.
So y'all are up against opposition on the. This is not obviously you're having to fight in the legislature to get these kind of common sense laws passed. What's the opposition that you're up against?
Well, the medical lobby, of course, the Texas Medical Association, opposes pretty much every pro-life bill. They actually were forced to agree to the Do Not Resuscitate Reform Bill in this last special session of the legislature. But up until then, they have opposed every pro-life bill that's ever been introduced, whether that's in regard to cloning, stem cell research, abortion, pro-life laws, and, of course, patients' rights. The Texas Medical Association is our main opposition.
Yeah, and this is an organization. Yeah, this is an organization that, you know, pretty much most doctors in Texas are a member of through the insurance or through different ways. So that's something I think a lot of doctors, you know, there's a lot of great pro-life doctors out there who have no idea what they're supporting.
Well, I'm convinced that if most of the doctors who are practicing medicine and who actually care for their patients, which I assume is most doctors, they do want to give really compassionate and attentive and detailed care to their patients. And if they knew what Texas Medical Association did for them in the Capitol, they probably would rescind their membership to TMA.
Wow. All right, Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about the services that Texas Right to Life provides to Texans who may be facing these kind of issues with a Texas hospital.
Well, if they call us for help, there's a wide range of ways we can help. Usually, we want to find out what the situation of the current patient is, so we try to find out the diagnosis, the insurance status, the current medicine, what therapies, if the person is breathing with a ventilator, or if the person needs dialysis. So once we gather patient information, we try to help the family learn which questions to ask of the doctors. And we also try to help the patient move to a more appropriate care setting or a different care setting if that's what the family is requesting. And so we help patients transfer to a different care setting. If the patient or the family is asking for legal help, we can set them up with lawyers who will help them on a pro bono basis. We have also helped people go to court for a temporary restraining order to stop the 10 days from taking effect. We have found people who will go and sit with the patient just to kind of be in the room and to ask questions and to look out for the patient's care. We have attended ethics committee meetings, or we call them futility review panels, with families and ask questions on behalf of the patient and the family. So really we can meet wherever the family is to assist wherever they are in the process so that they don't feel alone and frightened of the intimidating medical community.
Well, great. Well, thank you for being that resource there. I know if I were facing these issues, I would call Texas Right to Life. So I just appreciate y'all being a resource for Texans there. Thank you so much for being on the program, Elizabeth. We've got a ton of issues that we're going to have you back sometime to talk about some of the details of these things. I feel like we've just barely scratched the surface.
Thank you, Tony.
and we must put our principles into practice. That's what Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan touches on in this week's commentary.
What if on July 5th, 1776, the men who approved the Declaration of Independence casually headed home, believing their work to be done? With the Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan. Each Independence Day, I think of my ancestor, Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence. 2 centuries and numerous generations later, I take great inspiration from what he and his colleagues committed to in the summer of 1776. Just imagine how different the world would be had they not approached independence with a passionate commitment to liberty. Which brings me back to my question. What if on Friday, July 5th, 1776, the men who approved the Declaration of Independence casually headed home thinking their work was done? Sure, they had declared the equality of men and extolled the inalienable rights to life and liberty, and it must have felt good to vent frustrations about the king. But what if each man decided the talk of liberty shouldn't inconvenience anyone too much that weekend? Well, there would have been no new nation conceived in liberty. Rather than old glory, our public spaces would today be festooned with the Union Jack, or worse. The world would be a darker place. As a legal document, which is what the Declaration of Independence was under the terms of the Magna Carta, only John Hancock, as the President of Congress, actually had to sign it. But the others signed as well. After all, they had boldly pledged their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor to the cause of independence and liberty. No limits to that pledge. For them, everything was on the line. The cause of liberty was wrapped up in every facet of their lives. They saw the fight for political liberty as inextricably linked to providing for their families, serving in their churches, and ensuring the long-term prosperity of their neighbors. They didn't know if they would be hung the next week, bankrupted the next month, expelled from social circles the next year, or lost forever in the ash heap of history. But they believed in the righteousness of the cause. They knew liberty, as messy and inconvenient as it might be, was worth it for themselves and their prosperity. Let's not forget that it wasn't just those 56 signers who birthed our nation more than 2 centuries ago. Tens of thousands fought against the crown and for liberty, giving life to our democratic republic. Over the course of the War of Independence, the fields of America were watered by the blood of men, young and old, who believed dying for a chance of messy liberty was better than living under the yoke of a cultured and manicured tyranny. Even as so many of their names are lost to us in history, their legacy is this brilliant city set shining upon a hill. They gave their lives to securing the blessings of liberty. That's what they were willing to do the day after the 4th of July in 1776. In this year, once the parades conclude, the barbecues end, and the fireworks have exploded, what will we do for the cause of liberty on the 5th of July? That's the day that counts. And each day after. While it's good to celebrate our national independence, we must daily take actions to preserve our national liberty. Every day. The cause of liberty in our cities, counties, schools, state, nation, it needs us more than ever, and it's still worth it. Every day. With the Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan.
Well, that's it for this week. I hope you and yours have a happy and festive 4th of July. Down with King George, up with liberty. Let's preserve the legacy of our founding fathers. Join us back here next week for another episode of Texas Scorecard Radio.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.